Today, how the body influences the brain in mood disorders, an app to measure cognition, and a rundown of treatments for cognitive impairment in bipolar disorder. Welcome to the Carlyle Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlyle Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue.
In 1980, the Society for Neuroscience began lobbying Congress to increase funding for neuroscience research, and on July 18, 1990, their efforts paid off. President George H.W. Bush signed a formal proclamation declaring the 1990s the decade of the brain. At the time, I had just started working at the National Institutes of Mental Health, and the excitement was palpable. You could not go to a meeting or a lecture without hearing a reference to the new initiative and the promise it held. And by the end of the decade, most people judged it a success. Here's a few accomplishments from that decade of the brain.
The discovery of neuroplasticity. Before the 1990s, students were taught in Psychology 101 that the brain was a static organ that became kind of set in its ways by age 25. Now, they're given a more empowering message. Through neuroplasticity, the brain changes throughout life. Use it or lose it, is the mantra, or as Dr. Amen put it in his best-selling book, change your brain, change your life. Thanks to these ideas, older adults are taking up musical instruments, aerobics, and dexterity games in hopes of reshaping their brain and staving off dementia. But we also learned that some periods of neural development were more critical than others, such as early childhood, which led many states to launch preschool education programs. Next, the discovery of genetic mutations responsible for Huntington's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and Rett syndrome. Genetic advances like these have now entered clinical practice. And no, I'm not talking about pharmacogenetic testing, but testing for neurodevelopmental disorders with a genetic basis is now a routine part of the workup for autism and intellectual disabilities. If you're not already doing that, look for it in our upcoming June issue this year. We'll show you how. Also from the decade of the brain, the discovery of the neural origins of alcohol use disorders. And then, of course, a rush of new anticonvulsants and second-generation antidepressants and antipsychotics.
That decade is long past, and if we had to anoint the research of the current day, I'd call it the decade of the body and brain. The DSM continues to uphold a firm line in the sand between the brain and the body, with the exclusionary clause that the symptoms of most disorders cannot be due to the direct physiologic effects of another medical condition. That line, which looks so clean and sensible in the textbook, is getting increasingly blurred these days as we learn about the multitude of ways that physical health impacts mental health.
It looks like they blurred the line a bit already in the transition from DSM-4 to DSM-5. In the old DSM, we had to exclude symptoms that were due to a general medical condition, while in DSM-5, the wording is another medical condition. That word, another, suggests that psychiatric disorders are medical conditions as well.
In reality, I'm hard-pressed to think of a patient whose psychiatric disorder was not impacted in part by their physical health. It's often said that when a patient has treatment-resistant depression, that we ought to go back to square one and look at whether any medical conditions like hypothyroidism, anemia, or vitamin deficiencies are causing the depression. And I hope our listeners will diligently run a lab panel like that. Check out our June 2018 issue on treatment-resistant depression for a list of what to include. But I don't think our listeners are very excited to hear this advice, because they've learned from experience that those tests are fairly low yield. In fact, endocrinologists are currently debating whether we should routinely test for thyroid problems in depressed patients because false positive rates are high, and we end up treating a lot of cases of subclinical hypothyroidism that, in the view of our endocrinology colleagues, do not need to be treated. I myself am on the fence about the issue. I understand the endocrinology position, but I'm also aware that thyroid supplementation is a valid treatment for treatment-resistant depression.
So you may not find that elusive general medical condition that explains all your patient's symptoms, but you can make a big difference by pausing to consider how their physical health is impacting their brain, particularly in depression. That boils down to at least three categories, all of which overlap and influence each other in some way. 1. Hormones. That includes the hypothalamic pituitary axis, through which so-called stress hormones like cortisol flow, as well as reproductive hormones. 2. Inflammation. On this one, we have numbers. Inflammation contributes to 30% of cases of depression, and when it comes to treatment-resistant depression, that number jumps to 50%. The causes of inflammation are many. Here's a short list. Stress, from childhood trauma to recent stressful life events. Infection, whether active or recently, like within the past 6 to 12 months. Chronic medical illness, especially arthritis, autoimmune diseases, chronic pain, asthma, diabetes, cancer, and heart disease. Obesity, particularly a BMI above 30. Recent chemotherapy or radiation, and recent bodily injury or surgery. One of those, recent infection, has become particularly relevant in the COVID era. This month, a new study found that 52% of COVID-19 patients developed a full depressive episode within 4 months of the infection. 3. Metabolic health. It's not uncommon to see a psychiatric patient with obesity, diabetes, or high cholesterol, or with the vascular diseases from high blood pressure to coronary artery disease. Each of these metabolic problems has an independent effect on both mood and cognition, and in this month's Carlat Report, we featured an interview with Rodrigo Mansour, who is leading some of the research in this area.
In medical school, I learned all about end organ damage that diabetes causes, from the retina to the toes. But the brain was never really on that list, which never made sense to me. Why would the brain be spared from that kind of damage? Dr. Mansour's discoveries suggest that it is not spared, that diabetes increases the risk of depression, cognitive problems, and dementia.
It's the idea that insulin signaling in the brain is dysfunctional.
The brain, it turns out, develops insulin resistance, much as the rest of the body does. But insulin plays a different role in the brain.
Insulin signaling in the brain has some important differences from peripheral insulin metabolism. So the brain relies less than the muscle cells or the liver. It depends less on insulin to absorb glucose. As the brain, specifically certain areas, can absorb glucose independently of insulin. Insulin is going to mediate in the brain a lot of the usual suspects there in terms of feeding, ingesting behavior. But we have evidence that insulin's roles go beyond that. So insulin receptors are expressed in a variety of areas that are interesting for psychiatry. It's expressed in the prefrontal cortex, it's expressed in the nucleus accumbens, the ventral striatum, areas there that are relevant for cognition, for reward behaviors. And there's evidence now both from preclinical and clinical work that insulin modulates actual behavior. It's not just expressing these regions, but it modulates how these regions are activated, and that results in differences in behavior. We have the evidence that that's the case in obese populations, and we have done some work as well in individuals with depression.
The result of these physiologic changes is not just depression, but cognitive problems as well.
Individuals with type 2 diabetes, even if they do not have comorbid depression, they have a higher risk of having cognitive impairment and eventually progressing to dementia. So diabetes is one of the most well-recognized risk factors for late-life cognitive decline. There's very interesting data showing that even in early stages of mental illnesses, our patients already have some level of cardiovascular dysfunction there. It's a well-established fact that there is excessive and premature mortality in individuals with mental health issues. So individuals with depression, bipolar disorder, for example, they have a life expectancy that is approximately 15 years lower than their peers in the general population. The number one cause of death in this population is cardiovascular disease, right? No question that suicide is a key problem there, right? But in terms of overall absolute numbers, they are more likely to die prematurely from a cardiovascular condition. So no question that this is also an important mediator in the association between metabolic health and mood disorders.
Dr. Mansour went on to describe clinical situations where various anti-diabetic medications are being used to improve mood and cognition, including metformin, intranasal insulin, and a new class of medications that are being used for diabetes and weight loss, the glutides.
The glutides, mainly liraglutide, have controlled trial evidence to reduce weight gain on antipsychotics and more preliminary evidence to improve cognition. Some are available oral, and some, like liraglutide, are used as injections, but it's a very small needle and patients usually don't have problems with it. Liraglutide goes by the brand name Victoza when it's used for diabetes, and Saxenda when used for weight loss. In the article, Dr. Mansour talks about how and when to use these drugs, but emphasizes they are not first line in psychiatric practice.
Dr. Mansour is hard to keep up with. I arranged the interview to focus on his metabolic research, but after scheduling it, a software app was released that, to my knowledge, is the first free and validated app that measures cognitive functioning in patients. And Dr. Mansour played a role in validating it. It's called Thinkit, and Think is spelled THINC-IT. Since no one else spells Think that way, it's easy to Google it and get the download, or you can find the link in the podcast notes for this show. The website is progress.im, as in Mary.
Thinkit is a tablet-based tool to measure cognition. It's a tool that we validated a few years ago. Validation means we compared how it performed with the traditional pen and paper tests, and it performed quite well. And we also tested how reliable it was for repeated measures, like if you have to track someone over time, with or without treatment, if we could do that, if we could detect meaningful changes. And the validation results are quite good. And again, as I was saying earlier, it's not a perfect tool. There's no such thing. Cognition is extremely complex and heterogeneous domains, right? You have multiple subdomains, attention, memory, processing speed, working memory, cognitive control. So it's hard for a single tool or a single test to capture it all. But there is a need for clinical practice, for something that is easy to use and affordable. And that's where the Thinkit tool comes into, right? It's free. It takes 5 minutes. And give clinicians useful results for decision-making.
Here's what it looks like. First, you should use a tablet or laptop with a touchscreen. An iPhone is probably too small to do the problems. You could use a mouse, but that will be a little more challenging as it involves tasks, like connecting the dots that are easier to do with your finger. But hey, the test is only meant to measure change, so a mouse would still be valid. There are 5 tests. The first one is purely subjective. It asks the patient to rate their cognitive functioning. Next is Spotter, which measures reaction time. And for those neuropsychologists in the audience, it's based on the choice reaction time task. So, Dr. Aiken, how'd you do on that?
Here's how Spotter works. The computer flashes a right or left arrow, and you have to press the corresponding right or left arrow on the keyboard as quickly as possible. At first, I thought this was going to be easy. I mean, at least they are not asking you to press the opposite arrow, like the go-no-go test where you have to inhibit your instinctual response. But there is a catch. Sometimes they put the right arrow on the left side of the screen, and it's moments like that when you really feel the hemispheric split in your brain as your left eye registers the arrow, but your right hand has to press the button. So this one was harder than I thought.
Next comes symbol check, which measures working memory, the ability to hold a bunch of information in your head while you work. For those of you who caught last week's podcast, this is also known as the notorious NBAC test that might raise your IQ if you have the patience to regularly practice it. Let's see how Dr. Aiken did.
If you try this one, expect to fail the first few times. It takes a little while to get the gist of it. There's a long list of 5 different shapes moving through the screen. Triangle, square, hexagon, circle, and an X. You have to memorize the upcoming shapes, and when a shape hits the middle of the screen, it disappears. But you have to remember it and quickly name the shape that disappeared by touching a symbol on the screen. So it's a bit like the memory card game that children play, where the cards are revealed and then turned over and you have to remember them. Only here, there's a time element as well.
Next is Codebreaker, which you might recall from our podcast on cognition last winter is the famed digit symbol substitution test. It measures processing speed and a whole lot else. It's like those Dakota rings that have enchanted children since the time of Little Orphan Annie, where you have a ring with a series of numbers that correspond to letters, and they use it to interpret coded messages like 49112.
Remember, kids, only members of Annie's secret circle can decode Annie's secret message. Remember, Annie is depending on you. Set your pins to B2. Here is the message. 12, 11, 14. 11.
Let's see how Dr. Aiken fared.
Codebreaker is also hard, but it goes a lot better if you start by memorizing the 6 numbers on the decoder. Then you can breeze through as the symbols pass before your eye, because you'll know which number to correspond to without having to cross-reference it all the time.
And finally, the trail-making test. If you've ever used the Montreal Cognitive Assessment Test, which has taken the place of the mini mental status exam as a popular screening test for dementia, you'll recognize this one. There's a bunch of numbers and letters scattered on the screen, and you have to connect them like connect the dots. But you have to do it in order, alternating letters or numbers. So, A1, B2, C3, D4, and so forth. This is the only test that really benefits from a touch screen, although you could do it with a mouse. At the end of the test, it gives you a visual display of your score, and it graphs that over time as you hopefully improve. Dr. Aiken, these scores are confidential, so you don't have to share yours.
Well, I was average on most of them, except the dang digit symbol substitution test. I was below average on that. A lot below average. But there was one I was above average on.
What was that?
The self-assessment one. You know, the one where you subjectively rate your own cognition.
Well, keep up the good work there. And have you used it with any patients?
Yes, I've used it to measure cognition in patients as they recover from depression, and it's very encouraging because they can see that they're getting better. And sometimes their self-assessment gets worse even as their objective score is improving, which tells us something about self-awareness.
It says a lot about self-awareness.
Well, anyway, the test is particularly useful there. And it's also useful when you recommend an intervention that might improve cognition, like aerobic exercise, Mediterranean diet, or just getting better sleep through a behavioral program.
Or when starting a medication that improves cognition, like starting or switching stimulants. And we should mention this app is free because it is sponsored by the makers of vortioxetine, Trintellix. This antidepressant improves scores of the digit symbol substitution test, the one that Dr. Aiken bombed on. And though this test is very simple, it's actually a good predictor of work functioning. The digit symbol substitution test has been used for over 100 years, so it's well validated, and how well you score on it is unrelated to your IQ or educational level.
Dr. Mansour never received funding from Lundbeck, the maker of vortioxetine. The creation of the app was sponsored by the pharmaceutical company, but the tests themselves were developed long ago. So in terms of sponsorship, you can look at ThinkIt a lot like the free rating scales we use. You know, many of the ones that are free, like the Mood Disorder Questionnaire for bipolar or the Physician's Health Questionnaire for depression, are only free because pharmaceutical companies bought the rights to them and made them freely available. Here's how he recommends using it in practice.
You can use it as an assessment tool. Cognitive complaints are extremely common in our clinical practice. And the cognitive domain there, it's important to emphasize, is a key determinant of functional outcomes. So very frequently a situation in clinical practice when we are treating someone with depression is that their mood improves, but their cognitive function doesn't improve, at least not as much. That makes it particularly hard for them to return to their previous level of functioning. We have more than a few studies nowadays showing that one of the main determinants of functional disability in depression is actually cognitive dysfunction. It seems to have a stronger effect even more than depressed mood, for example. So it's an extremely important domain to monitor and assess. The assessment, however, as we talked before, can be quite complicated because there are a lot of variables there. You have numerous tests. You have cognitive batteries that take a lot of time that can be quite costly. I think it offers the advantage of being very simple to use. Again, it's free and can give clinicians useful information in terms of, you know, how their patients are performing cognitively at a certain period of time.
As I said, Dr. Mansour is hard to keep up with. And just as our interview went to press, he published a systematic review of treatments for cognitive impairments in bipolar disorder. The review included 11 medications, about half of which are not generally available in practice, like methylene blue or erythropoietin. But some of the medications he reviewed are more usable, like lurisidone Latuda, which had a single positive study for improving cognition in euthymic bipolar patients. It was randomized and controlled. And Sensoril, which is a proprietary extract of ashwagandha, an Indian form of ginseng. This one also had a positive controlled trial. The only problem with these two is that they only had one trial. The review also looked at transcranial magnetic stimulation and transcranial direct current stimulation. That one's unrelated to TMS. It's an electrical stimulation device that patients can use at home. Both of them had a few positive studies, just one each, actually. And it looked at psychotherapy. That's called cognitive remediation therapy, and it's similar to the kinds of therapies that have been developed for people with cognitive problems after, say, a stroke, dementia, or schizophrenia. It's a very active behavioral intervention. So the summary of this was that most of these are promising, but the data is too preliminary to say right now. And a few treatments did not work at all, even in the small studies that were available, and they're worth mentioning so you don't go jumping to them to try to improve cognition in your bipolar patients. They were pramipexole and N-acetylcysteine, the antioxidant. Both of these have positive data in bipolar depression, but they don't help cognition. And the dementia medication galantamine, which actually seemed to work worse than placebo.
Rodrigo Mansour, MD, is assistant professor in the Division of Brain and Therapeutics at University of Toronto. And now for the word of the day, rapid cycling.
Rapid cycling is a DSM specifier for bipolar disorder that means the patient has had four or more mood episodes in the past year. Often those episodes involve mania, depression, and mixed states, but a patient with bipolar disorder could cycle in and out of depression alone and still have rapid cycling. The term was coined in 1974 by David Dunner and Ronald Fieve when they observed that rapid cycling patients do not respond as well to lithium. Actually, these patients with rapid cycling don't respond very well to any medications, not just lithium. And although anticonvulsants are often touted as the preferred treatment for rapid cycling, recent analyses suggest they respond just as poorly to anticonvulsants as they do to lithium. In research, rapid cycling has responded to atypical antipsychotics, particularly quetiapine and olanzapine, but it's not clear if this response is any better than other options. Risk factors for rapid cycling include female gender, thyroid disorders, trauma history, substance use, and antidepressant use. Keep that in mind for our next episode, where we'll look at what mood experts do with antidepressants in bipolar disorder in their own practice.
Follow us on Twitter for your daily research update. Today's study is on a simple therapy that improved mood in patients with schizophrenia by guiding them to recall positive memories.
Send your feedback and questions of all things psychiatric to asktheeditor@thecarlattreport.com and stop by our website to get $30 off your first year subscription with the promo code PODCAST.
The Carlatt Report has operated free of industry support since 2003.